I think we started on this last week, and as I said last week, there's a lot that we can learn from Freud. Not everything he taught was wrong, but there's plenty there to critique, obviously, to say the least. And I think it become obvious, you know, as we go through this material. So I'll just briefly recap what we talked about last week, and then we'll go on and break some new ground. Okay. So we start out by talking about how Freud injected basically two insidious ideas into the bloodstream of Western civilization. And the first is this idea that belief in God is an infantile illusion. And we said, well, this isn't, you know, unique with Freud. Remember, Feuerbach was one of the foremost propagators of this idea a century before Freud. And Freud is very much influenced by Feuerbach, and but he'll go on and magnify that theme and make it all the more common in Western culture. And then secondly, this idea that human beings are driven not by reason and certainly not by moral sensibilities, but we are driven essentially by our primal instincts, in particular the sex drive, okay? And so we talked about how that he was influenced by people like Feuerbach, like Charles Darwin, for instance, with the idea that human beings are really just highly evolved animals. And, you know, if you buy into that naturalistic worldview, there's really no place for morality and ethics. At best, morality and ethics in a naturalistic atheistic worldview would be, I won't abuse you, so you won't abuse me. You know, I mean, that's about as moral as it gets. If everything is naturalistic and materialistic, there's no possible basis for true morality and ethics. Now, we talked a little bit about his life. He is, of course, he was an Austrian. He's a neurologist. He's oftentimes referred to as the father of modern psychoanalysis. Grew up as what he would call a godless Jew. And in fact, he would go on to describe himself as one of the most dangerous enemies of religion in the world. He was a very proud, arrogant, very demonstrative atheist, not one of these, you know, sedate atheists or anything. He's a real apostle for atheism. He grew up in a secular family. Religion was not a factor. But nonetheless, they're still Jews, and they're living in Catholic Austria, and so they're subjected to a lot of discrimination. And some of his biographers believe that this is one reason why he was so hostile toward Christianity, is because, of course, he equated Christianity with Catholicism and some of the discrimination that his family was subjected to in so-called Christian Austria. He's a very bright guy. He enters the University of Vienna at age 17, and then several years later, he graduates with an MD. He begins working in the Vienna General Hospital, but after 4 years, he resigns and goes into private practice, specializing in nervous disorders. And that was what most interested him, is why people are so angst-ridden, you know. And it's a legitimate field of study. Now, initially, he uses hypnosis in his clinical work, and he thought that under hypnosis, patients would relate memories of traumatic incidents that happened in childhood, and that this would provide insight into the current psychodramas and problems that they were experiencing. Thank you, Jay. Appreciate that. You know, this is a whole lot more comfortable being somewhat elevated. Okay. So initially, that's his approach. But then, very soon thereafter, he becomes intrigued with this field of psychoanalysis, and his goal here is to help people bring repressed repressed feelings to the surface into their consciousness so as to free them from these repressed emotions that they're experiencing. And so he'll do that using what he calls free association. In other words, he encourages patients to talk about their dreams. And he thinks that dreams are really just a form of wish fulfillment. But there's no scientific basis for that whatsoever. It's merely his theory, but that's the theory that he puts forth in his very famous book that he writes in 1899 called The Interpretation of Dreams. So what do you think of that? I mean, have you thought much about that? Do you think your dreams, to some extent or another, are expressions of wish fulfillment, or are these just random? They're dopey. Well, maybe yours are, Ray. You know. Yeah. Well, have you never felt like they were messages from your subconscious or messages from God? Now, we do know God can speak through dreams, and in fact, in very spiritually dark areas of the world, a lot of people are being brought to faith in Jesus Christ. You know, we know through miraculous means, including dreams and so on. But for us, as a normal course of things, has God ever spoken to you in dreams, and or have you learned anything about yourself through dreams? Or again, are these just what would be the word? Just but random ephemera. Ephemeral, random. So what do you think? Have you, Ray? What? Well, I have a hard time too. I wish I.
When I wake up, I want to tell Sally.
Right.
When I wake up, I can't remember.
Yeah, I typically have that problem too. And then other people have very sharp recollection, and I wish I did, but I surely don't. So Ray, what's your thinking on this? You're very. Yeah, right. Well, I would too. They're mostly nonsensical. But again, has anybody experienced otherwise?
I've never really thought about this much, but in Florida, I lived where there were coral snakes, and I dreamed one night that there was going to be a coral snake, that there was a coral snake right outside my back door.
Mm-hmm.
Walked out that very day, and there was a coral snake right there.
Okay, all right.
So,
but that was unique. You've never had,
yeah. Yeah. There it was instantly.
Yeah.
What a spiritual.
Yeah, I can't really claim that I've had many epiphanies or anything like that through dreams. I mean, I've had some interesting ones, but as far as spiritually enlightening, nothing much comes to mind. So nobody else is. Okay, well, we're all pretty much... Oh, except Wayne here.
Not about my dream.
Oh, okay.
But one of the Narnia books by Lewis, the main characters, it's an adventure story, the main characters encounter people that are escaping from an island where they say, your dreams come true. And originally, when they hear that phrase, they think, oh, that's great. You know, we can go there and our dreams will come true.
Mm.
Mm. And at that point, they're all terrified because of it and decide not to go there after all.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I certainly, again, wouldn't, like Ray, I wouldn't want mine to come true because they're mostly just nonsense and so on. Well, Freud, again, thinks these are messages from the subconscious to the conscious. And, but again, this is merely his theory. There's no scientific validation for it, anything like that. We also talked about how that he, late in life, he leaves Austria after the Nazi takeover of Austria in 1938. Now, here's somebody who is, for most of his life, apolitical, okay? Doesn't care anything about politics and social issues, whatever. He sees himself as above all of that. And, you know, to me, that's such a foolish and irresponsible mindset, and many Christians have that mindset, you know. I've certainly known many Christians. They must think that they're so spiritually minded that, you know, they're above and beyond, you know. But as we know, politics can absolutely wreak havoc in our world and havoc on people's lives. But Freud sees himself above all that until the Nazi takeover of Austria, and then his own daughter, Anna Freud, the famous daughter that succeeded him as a great psychoanalyst, she's actually apprehended by the Gestapo and interrogated, and at that point he begins to sense that politics actually matters, you know. This is serious stuff. And so through very influential friends in Britain and America, he's able to leave Austria in 1938, and he lives in Great Britain for the last year or so of his life. Now, he took a lot of his friends and family with him. I think about 15 people associated with Freud left Vienna and went to Britain. But among those left behind are his four sisters. And all four of those sisters wind up in Nazi concentration camps, and they were all killed in the war. So a further reminder, yeah, politics is messy and dirty, but politics matters. And it's very irresponsible on our part to be uninformed and unengaged. It has a big impact on people's lives. All right, so let's go on from that and look at the preface here, Freudian Psychology 101. And again, I'll try to move through this as quickly as possible because I don't want it to be tedious. But again, if you've not really thought much about this or read much about Freudian psychology since high school or college or whenever you first encountered it, a lot of this may not be real fresh in your mind. And as we said last week, most psychologists and psychiatrists today, very few of them claim to be Freudians, strict Freudians, but Freud continues to have strong influence on those fields of study and practice, even though many feel like they've moved beyond Freud in many respects. So we start with this idea that he puts forth, and that is that human thinking and human behavior are mysteries to the conscious mind. And I think he's absolutely right. I mean, unless you're a person who spends a lot of time in quietude and meditation and prayer and developing those kind of spiritual disciplines, I think it's real easy to live on a strictly superficial level. We live in a world full of distractions, and you can distract yourself to death, literally. I mean, you can just, never deal seriously with what's going on in your mind and in your heart, for your entire life. You know, when you think about it, most of the people who have ever lived on Earth lived in societies and cultures in which there was very little stimulation. Most of them were farmers or herdsmen or, you know, whatever, and they got very, very little stimulation, like as we do. Our problem is the absolute opposite. We live in a hyper-stimulated, overstimulated society and culture. Think about it. Until about 100 years ago, you never even heard music unless it was being performed live. And if you lived in some little village or town, maybe other than in church, you'd never even hear music. Today, you know, you can play it nonstop. And, of course, television and other, you know, visual arts and the Internet and that sort of thing. So most of humanity, their problem has been that they lived very drab, dull, boring, understimulated lives. Ours is absolutely the opposite. And so I think this really requires a change in mindset. We have to understand that our greatest challenge today is to filter out as much of this as possible. And it's really difficult to do because our whole culture is based on the presumption that we have to be entertained nonstop. So you can hardly go into a restaurant and have a decent conversation with all the music that's blaring. And it's almost invariably really bad music, too. I remember 20 years ago going with a friend down to Florida for 3 days to spring training. We went down there, and, you know, if you schedule it right, you can see a couple of games every day. You just kind of make the circuit around Central Florida there. So we indulged in baseball for 3 days, and I'd certainly gotten my fill for a while. You know, we'd seen 5 or 6 games. So we're coming back to Georgia, back to Atlanta, and we stop in Valdosta for lunch. And I don't know, it was maybe a McDonald's or something like that. And so we go in to sit down in the dining room there, and my friend immediately wants to sit where we can see the baseball games on TV. And I'm thinking, I've just about overdosed on baseball. You know, I need a break. I need peace and quiet. But he just couldn't get enough. And that's a major problem spiritually as well as emotionally, psychologically in our society. So Freud, even back in his day, and then, of course, his culture wasn't nearly as overstimulated as ours, but he understands that most people live strictly on the surface level. And they don't really understand what's going on beneath the surface. And so according to him, our consciousness is really just the tip of the iceberg. There's all this going on beneath the surface. And for the most part, it's buried beneath the surface in the realm of the subconscious. Now, he wasn't the first to theorize this, but he certainly popularizes the concept, and I think he's absolutely correct about that. Now, the problem is, again, that most people only operate on the surface level of consciousness, and the surface level, see, Freud would say, is only the superficial expression of our true self. For the most part, we act and we react according to just our impulses and emotions. Now, see, to some extent, the ancients understood this, which is why great philosophers like Socrates, for instance, always taught and always emphasized that we need to live according to reason, not according to emotions. So, you know, there's some realization of, you might say, human psychology, even among ancient philosophers, the good ones, the good ancient philosophers. Now, Freud would say, see, that we don't really know our true selves, and we don't really understand why we act the way we do in most cases. The subconscious is a reservoir, and it's a reservoir of past feelings and past experiences. And he says that bad experiences and memories are repressed there in the subconscious. We store these feelings in the subconscious. We repress them. And this would include a lot of the pain and hurt and anxieties and phobias and frustrations that we've had in the past. Now, hopefully this resonates with you, because I think we all, to some extent or another, you know, should relate to at least some of this, okay? Now, beneath the surface level, according to Freud, there are these psychodramas that are being played out, and sometimes they seep to the surface, or occasionally they explode to the surface. And so you might react in a certain way or say something, and all of a sudden you're kind of shocked that you did that or said that. Where did that come from? Well, Freud says, well, that's actually your true self. You've just been repressing it, say, but occasionally it explodes. Oftentimes at the most inopportune times. So he'll teach that human beings are constantly struggling with two basic impulses. One is we want to express ourselves freely, and so this quest for personal freedom and self-expression, we value that. On the other hand, we understand that we need to conform to society's expectations for proper behavior. So there's a tension here. Say, we don't always act and do and say exactly what we would like to because we're afraid of the repercussions. It's just not socially acceptable. So again, I hope some or a lot of this resonates with you. Yeah, you know, he's right. In many respects. Now, he writes in 1923 one of his most popular books called The Ego and the Id. And it's in that book where he sets forth his kind of view of the human psyche. And Freud says we basically have a tripartite nature. And he says at the very base level, what he called the id, well, that's our basic psychological makeup, and that's our basic instincts, our animalistic impulses and our passions. And he says this id is basically the reservoir of unconscious energy, and it's expressed or released via what he called the pleasure principle. And he says these impulses and these drives, of course, are totally unconscious. We're not really aware of what's going on, but they're very real. So that's part of our basic makeup, the id. You might say it's kind of our animal self. Okay. Secondly, he would say that we have a superego. In other words, we have a social persona. There's a certain way that we want to come across to other people and to express ourselves to other people. And this is all conditioned by our particular society's values. And so this is basically what you might call our socialized self. It's not our true self. It's our socialized image that we want to project to other people. And when we violate the superego, when we violate these social norms, the superego induces within us a sense of guilt that we've kind of crossed the line. We've done something inappropriate, okay? So we got the id, which sounds very emotion-driven, and then we've got our superego, where we're very careful of what we say and do because, again, we want to make the best impression on other people possibly. Best impression possible. Now, what's going to regulate these two extremes? Well, in Freudian psychology, it's the ego, and the ego is that conscious component of our psyche that you might say kind of mediates between the demands of the id and the superego. Now, Freud would teach, see, that a life that's totally driven by the id is going to be a life that's pretty much out of control. It's impulsive. It's uninhibited. It can be very aggressive, because frankly, that is part of human nature. And it could be it could be antisocial even, and it's psychologically unhealthy. And that's why we would call somebody who acts like this an idiot. Okay, they have no filter. They just explode. They're just totally emotion driven. Now, on the other hand, a life that's controlled by the superego is very inhibited and very repressed. It's a very superficial way of performing in public, and that's also psychologically unhealthy. And so the coping strategy then, when faced with unpleasant realities, unpleasant facts about who we truly are, or our experiences in the past, we try to keep these under control by using what Freud called the tactic of denial. In other words, denial, say, serves to preserve our sense of self-identity. We don't really want people to know exactly who and what we are, so we have to keep certain things repressed, just for our own ego sake. And then also, denial serves to preserve our worldview, in other words, our beliefs and our understanding of the world and external reality. And so, for many people, denial basically provides an escape from the anxieties produced by alternative views of reality, including, it helps us cope with who and what we truly are. So, in some cases, we not only deny the truth of what we truly are, but we actually even distort the reality of who and what we are in order to avoid these unpleasant, realities. And Freud would teach that this kind of coping strategy is particularly typical among neurotics and psychotics. And we'll talk about the difference in those two types of personality disorders here. But any thoughts on any of that up to this point? So again, hopefully at least some of this resonates with you. And again, we're all, you know, fallen, and we all have a sinful nature, and we all I think experience symptoms of what Freud is talking about. Obviously, with some people, it's a whole lot more extreme than with other people, but I think, you know, we all probably could relate to some extent at least. Anything? Okay. So what's the solution here? Well, actually, Freud understands that there really isn't a solution, but there's a way that you can at least become conscious and aware of what's going on in your life, in your subconscious below the surface. And first of all, he'll remind us that no one is perfectly mentally healthy. And this is one of those duh statements. You know, Jesus Christ was, but other than Jesus Christ, who is no mere human, have you known anybody that was totally, perfectly mentally healthy? And you don't have to volunteer your spouse or anything here as an example, but think about it. I mean, it's because we're flawed individuals. You know, we have a sin nature. And, of course, we're not perfectly mentally healthy. Again, to me, that's a no-brainer. I mean, we should all, you know, and it's always interesting that the more you get to know somebody, the more this becomes apparent. And actually, outside of us in this room, when you go out of this, there are some strange people out there, even in the church, you know, let alone outside the church. But again, it's rather obvious. Nobody is perfectly mentally healthy. Everybody is affected to some extent or another by psychopathologies. We're all scarred to some extent or another by our experiences in life. Although, again, some people's psychopathologies obviously are more extreme and more serious than others. And at a certain point, we would designate a person like that as being mentally ill. Okay? See, according to Freud, psychoanalysis is a way to at least expose your true self. In other words, it's a very methodical and it's a very incisive exploration of the self-conscious, of the subconscious, in order to identify why we think and act like we really do. And the underlying assumption here is that surface-level thoughts and behavior are based on subconscious emotions and fears and anxieties and agitations and aggressions. Okay. Now, systematic psychoanalysis, Freud would argue, can help. It can help us understand better who and what we truly are. But this is a process that takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of focused attention. And it takes a lot of commitment to get to the root of the problems that we have and our particular phobias. Now, to the benefit of psychologists and psychiatrists, this process not only takes a lot of time, it also costs a lot of money. And so many of them, like Freud, would argue that you need to be in psychotherapy your whole life because you never truly get to the bottom of the subconscious and who you are. It's a lifelong exploration, see? And so again, there may be a slight economic motive here in some of his theories. But ultimately, what's the point? The point is to strengthen your ego. In other words, if the ego is weak or if it's underdeveloped, the result is we live a life that's out of control. We don't have self-control like we should, or else we go to the other extreme, and if the ego is not strong, then we live a life that's very inhibited and very repressed, and neither one is mentally healthy. But this tension between the id and the superego remains an unresolved conflict, and there's no way really to deal with it. You can't starve your ego through self-denial, through asceticism. Freud would argue that asceticism, self-denial, doesn't work. All it does is just produce more angst within you. And on the other hand, of course, you can't deal with it through libertinism or through self-indulgence, because that just causes problems as well. So the section there in your notes, the solution is psychoanalysis. Well, actually, that's not a solution. And Freud was clear about that. The best it can do is reveal who you really are, you know, and maybe provide some insights as to why you think and act like you do. But is there a cure? Freud was honest enough to admit, no, actually, there's not a cure, see. And so we have to give him credit for that, see. And at least he was honest. A lot of psychiatrists and psychologists back then and today would try to argue otherwise, that they can cure people. But that's not possible. As we know, the fundamental problem is a spiritual problem. And Freud has nothing to contribute. And psychoanalysis actually has nothing to contribute to spiritual healing. And so as Christians, we understand that. But at least, again, he didn't make exaggerated claims that psychoanalysis could cure people, say, from their problems. Now, according to Freud, an integral part of our id is our libido. In other words, primarily here, he's talking about the sex drive. And he would describe the libido as an energy that generates erotic sensations, but also the libido generates neurotic guilt and even, to an extreme, death wishes and emotions like aggression and hate and so on. And he believed that the repression of the libido, which is what most people do who are living on the superego level, where they just want to impress, you know, other people, he would say that the repression of the libido is the cause, actually, for an awful lot of our anxiety and our mental illness. Now, according to Freud, sex is an outlet for our aggressions, and it's part of our biological processes. And by the way, again, see, we're only animals. We're only highly evolved animals. So if we can use this term, it would be wrong to repress the libido, okay? It needs to express itself. It's part of what we are, although there should be some checks and limitations. So if our sexual impulses, though, are being repressed, what it does is produce pent-up anxieties and aggressions that will manifest themselves either as neurosis, in other words, mental and emotional disorders and behavior. This would include masochistic tendencies that again, are stemming from all these internal psychodramas going on within us. So neurosis, which you might say is relatively mild mental illness, all the way to psychosis, which is extreme mental illness. And this would include sadistic tendencies, self-destructive tendencies, antisocial behavior, withdrawal from reality, and so on. So Freud would essentially say that most people are at least slightly neurotic, and some are far worse. They're actually psychotic.
This only presents the negative side of this. What about people that have delusions about greatness and grandeur? Is that kind of the other side of the same thing, right?
Yeah, that's a good question. How would Freud... And actually, you're kind of describing Freud, come to think of it. Delusions of grandeur. How would that fit into this? Good question. That's a good question. Does anybody have any insight into that? You're right. That's kind of the other side of things, you know. And I'm sure he addressed that, but I can't think of anything he necessarily wrote that, well, that addressed.
Those of us who dealt with mania and bipolar have seen the two extremes of the same thing.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Delusions, though, are a form of psychosis. So
yes.
Yeah. Psychotic or?
Yeah. And I'm sure he didn't see himself as deluded. But I think you're right, Julie. In its extreme form, in other words, the narcissistic personality, well, yeah, that's certainly can be a form of psychosis, you know. Thank you. I think that helps. Now, a problem with Freud, and again, we'd want to say, well, there's some truth in this, and, you know, the sex drive is a very powerful drive. And again, it varies, you know, from person to person, but nonetheless, it's always present, it's always a force. And but the problem with Freud is he so exaggerates the sex drive and over-emphasizes it and over-sexualizes virtually everything in life. In fact, he considered all addictions, even cigarette smoking, to be substitutes for masturbation, which he called the one great habit. Okay, and now, why is it that we feel such guilt when it comes to the sex drive? Well, Freud says this is the result of growing up in a culture that was influenced by Christian and biblical values, that biblical values are a major inhibiting and repressive factor in society, and it induces guilt. I'm not sure that Freud ever went so far as to say that there should be no limitations on sexual activity, although in his own life he certainly expanded the boundaries considerably beyond his own marriage. But he would say that, generally speaking, most people live unhealthy lives because they're suppressing the libido, and that's due to Christian and biblical teachings, okay? Which was one reason why he claimed to be so hostile toward Christianity and the Bible. Any thoughts on any of this before we move on? Oh, listen, he's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Never had a latency period, he would say. Yeah, Woody Allen would be the perfect expression of Freudianism in popular culture. Look at his most famous movies, Annie Hall and Manhattan, some of those. And there's just constant Freudian allusions in those movies. And you're right. He was very much immersed in Freudian psychology, and it's pretty obvious in some of his movies. Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's look here at a critique, okay? The theory of and practice of psychotherapy, let's critique it. Is psychotherapy compatible with the Christian faith? Now, C.S. Lewis argued, and I think he's generally right about this, that there's nothing about psychoanalysis that's necessarily incompatible with Christian faith. I mean, we all understand that we do have these internal repressions. We're scarred from our experiences in the past, disappointments, anxieties, phobias, and so on. And Furthermore, Lewis would argue that psychoanalysis can help reveal root causes of many of the fears that we have and many of our personality quirks. And some Christians have gone so far as to interpret Freud's three aspects of the psyche as representing, for instance, the id. Well, they would say, well, that's the fallen nature of man. That's our again, Freud would say animalistic impulses, we'd say that's the, you know, seat of our aggression and hostility and egocentrism and so on. And then the ego, some Christians would say, well, that's our conscious mind. And then the superego is our active conscience. Now, Freud would not have agreed with that, but again, some Christian psychologists and all would say, yeah, that tripartite nature of man is compatible with Christian theology. But there's two fundamental incompatibilities between a Freudian and a Christian philosophy of psychology. And we have to keep in mind, as Lewis pointed out in Mere Christianity, that psychology and psychiatry, there are elements of science in these fields of study, but they are also probably mostly philosophical, and that's the problem. See, the problem is not the science, but the philosophy, which with Freud and with most of the popular psychologists and psychiatrists of the last century, they were operating out of a very secular, humanistic worldview perspective. So their interpretation of what's going on is the problem. And so there's a couple of problems here, a couple of incompatibilities, as I said. And the first is that Freudian psychology tends to label character flaws as a form of mental illness. Now, let's put it a different way. Freudian psychology tends to label sins, expression of sins, as forms of mental illness. Now, I'm not arguing that sin can't drive you into mental illness, but it's not innately an expression of mental illness. It's an expression of rebellion against God. Therefore, see, based on this assumption that the secular psychologists hold, guilt is treated as a form of neurosis. In other words, if you feel guilty about anything, this is indicative of a form of mental illness, and psychoanalysis attempts to address that, see. Now, a great source here, and I haven't read extensively on spiritual psychology. I've read a little bit over the years, and there's been two books in particular that I thought were just absolutely astonishingly brilliant. And one is Paul Vitt's book, Psychology is Religion, The Cult of Self-Worship. Is anybody familiar with Paul Vitt's? Ray, you are? Anyone else? He's a professor of psychology, or at least used to be until I think he might have retired recently, up at New York University, NYU, and very strong Christian, a very perceptive Christian. And he wrote this book, back in the early 80s or something, Psychology is Religion, The Cult of Self-Worship. And it's just brilliant. I'd highly recommend it. I'll write it down here. Paul Vitt's Psychology as Religion. In other words, the way psychology is presented in popular culture, mainstream culture, it basically is a surrogate religion, and that's where he gets the title, okay? The Cult of Self-Worship. And the second book that is just astonishingly insightful is Philip Reif. And it's called The Triumph of the Therapeutic. Triumph of the Therapeutic. And here he's arguing that instead of operating primarily on the basis of truth and morality, psychology and psychiatry largely is an emphasis on just therapy. It doesn't deal with truth and morality and right and wrong. It's all about how to make people feel good about themselves and to feel comfortable about their current state of affairs. And maybe there's a few, you know, minor things you need to, you know, address and work on. But basically, you're okay. You know, you don't have any fundamental problem. So it's this whole therapeutic mentality. And of course, again, even when it comes to therapeutic counseling, there certainly is some truth there, and there's certainly a place for it. But it doesn't even begin to address with root causes of people's problems. And Christian psychology, on the other hand, or let's say a Christian understanding of psychology, acknowledges the reality of sin. And therefore, Christians understand that guilt is very real, and it's very legitimate. Guilt is not something to be denied. Guilt has to be dealt with, and the only way that we can alleviate guilt is through confession of sins and through repentance. Then we allow spiritual healing to take place. So that would be a very key fundamental difference in, let's say, secular humanistic psychology, which is 95% of, you know, popular psychology, and a Christian understanding of human nature and how to deal with our problems as human beings. Okay? So secondly, then, psychoanalysis cannot give us the power to overcome our problems. This requires spiritual power, and it has to come from a source outside of ourselves. See, the Freudians and the secular humanists will argue you can fix your own problems. I mean, if you have any real problems at all, you have the capacity within you to heal yourself. And nothing could be more unbiblical, more unchristian than that kind of an attitude. Freudian psychology and psychotherapy holds that human beings have all the resources they need to fix themselves. And, of course, even in this sense, as I said a while ago, Freud apparently himself was not all that convinced, because he did seem to acknowledge, at least in some of his writings, the limits of psychotherapy. And he admitted in one of his writings, quote, "The therapeutic effect of psychoanalysis can only produce at best the substitution of something conscious for something unconscious." In other words, see, Freud here is saying that at the best, what psychoanalysis can do is make us understand a little more clearly why we're so dysfunctional, but it doesn't have any power to fix us. And two basic fundamental contradictions there in secular humanistic psychology and Christian approach to psychology. Christians acknowledge that we are slaves to sin, and that we're in desperate need of divine intervention, desperate need of divine help, and we can't fix ourselves. Or as R.J. Rushdoony put it, having denied sin, Freud has also denied salvation. For in reducing guilt to biology, in other words, I'm not responsible for my actions, I'm not guilty for anything, it's just my genetics, it's just my biology, Freud had no way of enabling man to transcend his biology and hence transcend or escape his biological sense of guilt. So again, I think a perceptive quote there from Rushdoony that again sort of crystallizes the difference here, the problem, as we analyze and critique Freud, or you might say as we put Freud on the couch. So any thoughts on some of those points?
Did he take cocaine? Was he an addict
himself? Yes. I mentioned that last week. I meant to mention that again this week as well. For 10 years, he was addicted to cocaine.
Was that kind of the outgrowth of his thought that could do something that he couldn't really conquer by psychoanalysis?
Let's see. That's a good question. His understanding of cocaine, and of course people didn't know as much about it back then as they do today. Remember, it was in Coca-Cola back in those days. But he saw it as he saw it for its medicinal purposes. He thought that it eliminated pain and had positive effects. And then he realizes that actually he's addicted to it. So over time, he began to have second thoughts on the value of cocaine. But, you know, a lot of his early psychological theories are worked out while he's under cocaine, so that alone would be cause for some suspicion, I suppose. Be like, a philosopher on LSD, you know. I mean, you'd probably want to question, you know, what insights he's receiving there. You know. Pardon me? Yes, it would do that if you were on LSD, well, or cocaine, yes. It does kind of broaden your experiences, yeah, in that respect. Any other thoughts? All right, now, in the early 1960s, there was a psychologist who was very well known and respected. He was a former president of the American Psychological Association, and his name was Hobart Maurer. Is this a familiar name to anybody? Is anybody familiar with Hobart Maurer? Oh, okay, Julie. Julie, do you work in this field?
I did. I retired. I'm a licensed marriage
attorney. Oh, great. Well, you can help us out here.
Oh, I'm not
in
sure.
In fact, well, I don't envy you. Yeah, let me just ask you, I mean, how would you respond to everything we've said up to this point? And is there anything you'd correct or disagree?
No,
yeah,
no.
Disagree?
It, uh-huh. The psychosis and neuroses, of course, I've got more detail on that, but not anything relevant.
Mm-hmm.
I agree exactly with what you said.
Mm-hmm. So you don't think we've misrepresented anything?
No,
okay.
Not at all.
All right. Okay. Because if I have, it's not my fault. It's these anxieties I feel. I'm perfectly innocent. Okay. Well, please enter in anything that think you need to add to. Well, as I said, in the early 1960s, Hobart Maurer, a well-respected figure in the APA, began a major reassessment and reaction against Freudianism. And in a book he wrote in 1961, which was pretty influential in the field of psychology, called The Crisis in Psychiatry and Religion, Maurer challenged the dominant philosophy of mainstream psychiatry, which again is secular humanistic. Okay. Now, keep in mind, Maurer is not a Christian, but Maurer is wondering and questioning in his book why Christians who purport to believe in the Bible have so easily been sucked into Freudian psychology. And in particular, he accuses evangelicals, Bible-believing Christians, of, quote, selling their birthright for a mess of psychological pottage. Now, his great contribution was in the fact that Maurer rejects what we would call the medical model of psychiatry or the therapeutic model of psychiatry, which regards the patient as merely a victim of mental illness and of irrational guilt feelings. And instead, Maurer wants to substitute this medical model for a moral model, which argues that patients need to acknowledge and take responsibility for their deviant thinking and their deviant behavior. We need to act like real adults and take responsibility for what we do and say and so on. In other words, neurotics need to face up to the fact that they suffer from real guilt, not false guilt. Or as Maurer put it, quote, "The basic irregularity is not emotional, it's behavioral." That's our problem, see, as far as he's concerned. The patient is not a victim of his conscience, but a violator of his conscience. I mean, that sounds like you've got an inherent compass, a moral compass, which, you know, is quite compatible with Christian theology, natural law, natural moral law theory. And so Maurer would go on to say that we need to stop blaming other people and we need to accept responsibility for our own poor behavior. Problems can be solved not by ventilating our feelings, but rather by confession of sin. Now again, he's not actually a Christian, but he understands what Judaism and Christianity teaches. He understands what the Bible teaches about these things, and he finds biblical insights into psychology to be more in sync with reality than Freudianism is. And so Maurer criticizes Freudian psychoanalysis as what he calls an archaeological expedition back into the past in which a search is made for others on whom to pin the blame for your own behavior. In other words, he's criticizing what we would call today the victimization mentality. I mean, we see it so rampant today. We see it, you know, in played out in the social realm today, as well as obviously in people's private individual lives as well. Maurer's saying, you know, you need to take responsibility and stop blaming your dysfunctionality on other people or other circumstances. So Maurer's moral model, which he emphasizes over the so-called medical model. Now, one issue that continually comes up today when it comes to this medical model is, again, how do we think about, for instance, addiction, drug and alcohol addiction, and how do we respond? See, and there are those who will claim that it's an illness. And I'm not sure they mean to imply this, but it sort of implies that you're just kind of an innocent victim. You're an innocent victim of your genetic and chemical makeup. And there's some truth in that. Obviously, we know that some people and some ethnic and nationality and racial groups have more propensity toward alcohol or drug addiction than others do. So I'm not in any way implying that there's not a genetic chemical factor here, but to attribute it mostly to that rather than to personal behavior is where I think, you know, it becomes, it facilitates irresponsible thinking and irresponsible behavior. None of us are totally perfectly mentally healthy. Furthermore, none of us are totally perfectly physically healthy, are we? We all, you know, I mean, we're the umpteenth generation in human history, and there's good reason to think that the genetic gene pool is getting more and more and more corrupted from generation to generation. So we understand that. But having conceded all that, we still are personally responsible and accountable before God for how we live our lives. And if we need special help, then we have a moral and spiritual responsibility to do just that, to recognize it and reach out for special help. So, Julie, what would you say about that?
Mm-hmm. They are not ever probably going to be able to effectively deal with that.
Yeah.
Yes, and I think if you give them an allowance for that and say you're a victim, I don't think that's helpful for them, their family, or anyone.
But undoubtedly, it's harder for some people than others. There's no question about that. And we do need to be sympathetic, you know. But again, only within certain limits, right? Yeah. And I think that's one thing that's always sort of unsettled me about the AA and 12-step philosophy is that it would you agree it sort of operates on this therapeutic level rather than or the medical level rather than the moral.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think it's only a piece.
Right.
It can only be a piece
right.
of treatment.
Right. So, I mean, since we've experienced it personally in our family with one of our children. I mean, my heart really goes out to these people. But again, ultimately, we're personally accountable and responsible, aren't we? And we all have our issues that we have to honestly deal with in life. Wayne? Yeah, that's all we are, is just physicality, materiality. Yeah, yeah, I think so. In other words, see, Freud, he doesn't believe we have a spirit. Everything is material, which again makes his whole theory of conscious and unconscious nonsense. There's nothing material that you can say is your consciousness, you know, or your subconscious for that matter. Well, let's move on here then, and so anyway, C.S. Lewis, his critique here is that there's a science behind some of this, but it's mostly philosophy, and it's philosophy that stems from a secular humanistic worldview. So we need to be very conscious of that and rather skeptical, you know, when it comes to some of the dominant assumptions in the fields of psychology and psychiatry. All right, now let's look at The Future of an Illusion, the book that Freud wrote that I wanted to spend a little bit of time on. And one of Freud's biographers, in fact, probably his most prominent biographer, is a great biographer by the name of Peter Gay. And Peter Gay writes that, quote, "To demolish religion with psychoanalytic weapons had been Freud's agenda for many years." So this man was an evangelist. He was an apostle. He was totally anti-God and wanted to destroy the last vestiges of Christianity and, for that matter, just the last vestiges of theism. In 1913, he wrote a book called Totem and Taboo, in which he theorized about the origin of religion. And it's some of the most preposterous nonsense you can ever imagine. I won't even waste time talking about it, but it's just pure crackpottery. And so later, he revised his theory as far as the origins of religion. And in 1929, he wrote a book called Civilization and Its Discontents. And he argued in this book that religious belief is a form of mass delusion. And Freud puts it this way. He says, well, of course, nobody, needless to say, who shares a delusion ever recognizes it as a delusion. So religion is a form of mass delusion, but don't expect somebody who believes in religion to know that or acknowledge it, according to Freud. Now, in a previous book, The Future of an Illusion, that he wrote in 1927, he reaffirms, quote, "my absolutely negative attitude toward religion in every form." And now he's attributing religion and belief in God to wish fulfillment. And, you know, now when you think about it, when a atheist makes pronouncements like this, that belief in God is a projection of your own internal need for God. It's a form of wish fulfillment. Well, keep in mind, see, that we can turn the argument around. It cuts both ways. And we can equally argue that unbelief in God is a form of wish fulfillment. In other words, the refusal to believe in God, see, can clearly indicate that a person just doesn't want to deal with the reality that there might be a God to whom he's individually accountable. So, again, when atheists want to, again, put the onus on us and say, well, you just want to believe that there's a God, well, maybe they just don't want to believe there's a God. They don't want to be accountable to a higher moral authority, okay? So if we're going to psychoanalyze each other, you know, it works just as much for them as it does for us. Now, Freud, though, will argue that belief in God was a childlike fantasy that came from our fear of nature. In other words, obviously, we live in a very dangerous and insecure world. And so, according to Freud, we live constantly in a state of anxiety and fear. There's a lot of stuff out there that could harm us, you know, wild animals and wild human beings, for that matter. And so we'd like to think that there's this almighty, benevolent, loving Father who created the world and who can protect us from all these fears in the world. And he says that's where religion came from. People are too uncomfortable. They're too fearful of living in the real world. So they'd like to believe that there's a God who loves them and provides for them. And even after you die, he'll still provide for you, you know, after this life is over. So now, based on that assumption, Freud will go on to say that because belief in God is a figment of the imagination, then belief in God is by extrapolation, see, a form of mental illness. In other words, belief in God is an expression of neurosis. It's people who are too fearful to deal with reality. So belief in God is a form of mental illness. And in a rather astonishing admission of narcissism and egomania, and maybe even mental illness, Freud declares that if there were in fact a God, God would be accountable to Freud, not vice versa. And this is how he puts it. He says, "I stand in no awe whatsoever of the Almighty. If we were to ever meet, I should have more reproaches to make to him than he could make to me." And so, you know, apparently this is not somebody who's on the verge of, you know, conversion to the Christian faith. He's saying that God's more accountable to me than I am to him. And you know, his argument will be what Richard Dawkins and a lot of these others say, and that is, well, if there really is a God, why hasn't he made his existence more obvious and clear? You know, but these are people that will never be satisfied. You know, if you looked into a microscope and you examined the human cell, even if it were imprinted on the cell made by God, they'd still claim that wasn't sufficient evidence. You know, they'll never be satisfied because, frankly, they don't want to believe. They hate the very idea of God. They don't just disbelieve, they hate God. I love the way G.K. Chesterton put it, and he said, you know, this is not true of all atheists, but there is a certain kind of atheist who doesn't so much disbelieve in God as personally dislikes him. So I think that is pretty indicative of Freud. So Freud says, you know, people who believe in God, all it does is distract them from real-world concerns. Freud is a utopian idealist, like Karl Marx and like so many of these authors we've studied. And he says that, you know, belief in God and religion, that just wastes people's time and energy and money and so on. They could be spending all that time and energy and money making this world more tolerable for everybody in the world and for civilization. And so his solution to the problem of belief in God is to embrace science as he understands it. So like Darwin and like Nietzsche and like some of the others we've talked about, he challenges his readers to grow up and to leave this childish illusion of God behind and admit, quote, man's insignificance or impotence in the face of the universe. And, you know, frankly, that is the gospel of atheism. That is the good news of atheism, and that is that we're totally insignificant and we have no purpose and meaning. We're a fluke of the universe. There's no destiny when you die, and that's the gospel. That's the gospel of atheism. And this is why when Richard Dawkins makes utterly absurd comments like, for instance, Darwin made it possible for me to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. What would an intellectually fulfilled atheist look like? This is somebody who believes that they're a fluke of the universe, that they're just a highly evolved animal. They have no meaning and purpose in life. They're going to die and go extinct. They'll no longer function as a sentient life form. And this provides intellectual fulfillment. I mean, what a fool. What a foolish statement to make, you know. And Freud was the same way. He's a fool, you know. Let's see. Oh, well, we'll finish up here real quickly here. Let me kind of crystallize some of the... any attempt at putting forth a moral philosophy is quite irrational when it applies to Freud. See, according to him, human beings are naturally amoral because in a humanistic, materialistic world, there's no criteria for morality. Everything is just physical and material. When a lion attacks and kills and eats a zebra, we don't say that was an immoral act. We don't say that the lion sinned. That's just how animals behave, okay? And we're just highly evolved animals. And so there is absolutely no basis for morality or ethics, according to this worldview. Yet Freud understands, and this is sort of the bottom line when it comes to morality for atheists and I presume agnostics as well, and that is that the only reason that we don't prey on other people more than we do is because we wouldn't want them to do it to us. So we have to erect some boundaries. So I won't abuse you in hopes that you won't abuse me, see? And that's about as high-level moral thinking as you're going to get out of these people. Now, in a couple of weeks, of course, we have a forum coming here with Richard Howe and Melvin Fine. And do we need God to be good? And Melvin Fine is, in many respects, a very, very impressive person. He's a sociology professor at Kennesaw State. He has devoted his career there to fighting against this left-wing, politically correct culture that discriminates against conservatives and Christians and so on. And the man has been absolutely fearless. I have a lot of respect for him in that regard. But Mel is also an agnostic. By the way, he really likes Christians, so be sure you're nice to him, okay, when he comes. We might be able to have a real positive impact on him. He's an agnostic. And I don't know how he's going to try and argue the case, do we need God to be good? But I suppose he's going to reduce it to what a lot of people like that do, and that is, what is right and wrong? Well, the bottom line is, what is it that contributes to human flourishing? That's the term they like to use, human flourishing. And whatever contributes to human flourishing is good and right, and whatever does not contribute to human flourishing is wrong, and I guess they'd even say immoral. But there's some real problems with that argument, the probably rather obvious problems with that argument. So it'll be interesting to hear Mel's position. But as I said, in so many areas of his life, we would find him to be a very admirable person, and I have a certain amount of respect for him. Like I said, he's stood up to these liberal fascists who run our universities and colleges, and I know very few Christians who have stood up as he has over the years. But again, we ought to pray for him and hope that this forum has a good impact, you know, on his life. He's, in many respects, a very wonderful guy. So anyway, I guess we can kind of draw things to a conclusion there. And that is that that's sort of the bottom line for atheist ethics and morality. And that is don't abuse other people, and hopefully they won't abuse you. And then you can both flourish, whatever that means, and that's as much as you can expect out of life. Okay, so not a very satisfying bottom line, is it?